About a year ago, fighting in northwestern Pakistan between the government and insurgents uprooted roughly 3 million civilians. Today, according to a group of 35 aid and development organizations, just under half that number are still refugees within their own country. Joining us now is Michael Young, the International Rescue Committee's Asia Regional Director. He recently returned from Pakistan, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today for our first underreported segment. Hello.
Hello.
Can you give us a little background on what happened in the northwestern part of Pakistan about a year ago?
Certainly. I mean, as people are aware, there were a series of counterinsurgency campaigns mounted by the Pakistani government and army against Taliban and other militant groups in Pakistan.
Had they taken control of that area?
In SWAT, you could characterize it like that. Certainly, the immediate precursor to the army's intervention was a peace deal between the government and the Taliban movement.
Now, had most of the refugees left their homes because the Taliban were being repressive or because of the military offensive?
The immediate cause of the mass movement of millions of people was the military offensive in Swat Valley and other areas of Malakand Division in northwest Pakistan, yes.
Is there still a low-level conflict going on between the government and the Taliban?
There is a series of campaigns against the Taliban, and there is continuing insecurity in other areas of the Northwest Frontier Province. The 1.3 million displaced people, which you pointed out in your introduction, that still exist in Pakistan, I mean, it's a changing population. You have people who have been displaced and exiled from their homes from, for instance, the northern tribal areas since late 2008. So they've been displaced in camps and outside for a long time. You have others who are just arriving.
Are they staying nearby, or are they dispersing throughout the country?
No, by and large, they're staying nearby their homes in the northwest frontier province.
A year ago, the New York Times called the refugee crisis the worst since the partition from India in 1947. Can it be that bad? I mean, millions died after the partition.
It is that scale of crisis. I mean, just in terms of the speed and the dislocation of people having to flee their homes, it was the largest such movement since Bosnia or Rwanda. And levels of need were very, very high because people fled with nothing and still are.
In your estimation, has the situation improved at all since last year?
Certainly. I mean, there are elements that are what you could characterize as a success story or a positive development. People have returned to the Swat Valley. People are trying to rebuild their lives, but that's more than balanced out by people still fleeing from other areas.
And you said that they fled with nothing. There was an article in the UK's Telegraph this morning which mentioned that some of the refugees have had as little as 10 minutes to grab their possessions and flee their homes during brief ceasefires. So in some cases, they're just going out with the clothes on their back and a few things they can carry.
That's right. And that's not in some cases. That's the majority experience, if you can characterize it like that.
So what happens when these displaced people are in some kind of refugee camp? They're starting with nothing.
They're starting with very little, and they're selling whatever limited assets they have right at the start of the process to try and fund their exile. I mean, most of them are not in refugee camps, it has to be pointed out. Most of them actually rely on the hospitality of either extended family or strangers.
Strangers? They're living with complete strangers?
Yes. In fact, at the time of the SWAT refugee crisis, you know, 3 million people, surveys carried out by Pakistan Humanitarian Forum member agencies found that, in fact, the majority of those people were living with strangers.
Well, that can't always be the most secure situation, especially for women.
No, there are many issues with that. First of all, it makes people who have very high levels of vulnerability and need more difficult to reach because they're scattered among the population. Secondly, there are issues around rights and potential for exploitation and abuse. But it really is a testament to Pakistani society that so many people opened their homes to people. You had some households who hosted over 100 people in their family compounds.
So I'd imagine that this has put an incredible burden, millions of people moving on the infrastructure in the places they're staying, the roads, the water systems, sanitation.
That's entirely right. I mean, you're already talking about districts, by and large, that are poor and have low levels of service to begin with. And then you have hundreds of thousands of people moving into those districts. It far passes by the capacity of public services to respond.
And I'm assuming also that the fighting has destroyed some of the infrastructure in the places they're fleeing.
It's variable. In somewhere like Swat, there wasn't a greater deal of physical destruction. In somewhere like South Waziristan or the northern tribal agency of Bajo, it's very destroyed.
And what is the government doing about that? Are they trying to rebuild any of the destroyed infrastructure?
They are. I mean, the Pakistani army and the civilian authorities are involved in reconstruction planning and programming.
Although this is a country that has other kinds of crises, Pakistan's prime minister announced a new national energy-saving policy this week. The country has faced massive electricity shortages.
Yes, I mean, it's a state that's trying to cope with multiple overlapping crises.
And why would they have electricity crises?
It's a simple power supply problem.
But they have dams, don't they?
They have dams, but they don't have enough dams, as simple as that. They don't have enough dams. They don't have enough electricity supply from rental power plants. It's a long-standing infrastructural issue.
And what about the refugees? What do they need most at the moment? Food, medicine, housing?
It really is. I mean, it ranges from the most fundamental life-saving needs, shelter, food, clean water, sanitation, through to livelihoods and education.
Now, normally when we hear about problems in Pakistan, we hear about Kashmir. Has Kashmir died down, or is this just so much bigger, this problem is so much bigger that we're not even getting news from Kashmir?
I think so. I mean, obviously, this is a very urgent situation. It's a crisis. It continues to be a chronic crisis, if you could put it like that. So issues of development and stability in Kashmir do tend to slip down the kind of attention agenda.
My guest is Michael Young, Asia Regional Director for the IRC. We're talking about Pakistan's ongoing refugee crisis on our first underreported segment today. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Didn't the UN and the Pakistani government and various NGOs request over $500 million earlier this year for aid for the refugees? What happened?
They did. They made an appeal for $537 million. Sad to say that appeal remains drastically underfunded.
How much have they gotten?
About 20% of the total planning figure. And that was a very conservative planning figure that didn't take account, for instance, that there are 5,000 people moving out every day.
Why do you think there's so much resistance? The worldwide economic crisis? Or is Pakistan seen as a kind of a hole that you can just keep on throwing money into?
Well, I think there are multiple factors involved, and it's hard to pin down any one issue. The appeal came out in the wake of the Haitian earthquake, which obviously that dominates the agenda, and the needs there are vast. So a lot of big government aid agencies, that was their number one priority, and so Pakistan moved down the priority ranking. Pakistan has historically been a difficult place to fundraise for. The fact that there are continuing dire humanitarian needs often doesn't attract the kind of attention you need to generate the funding from donors.
Well, where is most of the money coming from?
Right now, most of the money is coming from the U.S. government. They're producing 60% of the funded total so far.
And not countries like Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia has pledged $100 million, but that's got a little tangled up in bureaucracy and is not reaching the ground yet.
How badly was Pakistan's economy hurt by the economic crisis?
It did get a hit, not as probably as severe as many people expected. It was not so much the economic crisis as a kind of a parallel food crisis that was more destabilizing for Pakistan.
What kinds of challenges does a group like yours face when you're trying to deliver aid in Pakistan?
Well, multiple overlapping challenges. First of all, it is still possible to work on the ground in Pakistan and deliver aid to those people who need it. There are security issues. There are funding issues, obviously, as this latest Pakistan Humanitarian Forum appeal makes clear. But going back to your earlier comment, I mean, one thing we guarantee is that every dollar that reaches agencies like IRC or other members of the Pakistan Humanitarian Forum does get translated into work on the ground.
Well, you can't guarantee that if the money is funneled through the Pakistani government.
Yes, but most of the humanitarian funding does not go through the Pakistani government. It goes through either the UN system or directly to agencies like the IRC.
Why are the NGOs also subject to attack? Earlier this week, there was a report that suicide bombers dressed as women in burqas attacked a food aid distribution point in Kohat, and that killed at least 41 people.
There are a lot of complex underlying reasons for that. The Kohat camp attack, for instance, was probably more attributable to sectarian violence than kind of government Taliban violence.
It's often pointed out that the Taliban and other groups don't like NGOs because they see them as a threat, as competition. If the Taliban wants to come across as the group that's helping the local people, then the NGOs are the enemy.
You could say it like that. I mean, for example, ISC has been in Pakistan working with Afghan refugees and now Pakistani displaced people for over three decades now. And by and large, we haven't had a great challenge in reaching the people that we need to reach. And we work mostly in the Northwest Frontier province.
What is the security situation for the aid workers? Is it provided by the government?
No, pretty much our member agencies provide their own security.
Uh-huh. And that's what you have to do, the IRC?
That's right. And we adopt a very low-profile approach. Because we've been in Pakistan for so long, as have many of our colleague agencies, we know the communities very well. They know us, and that creates trust.
When the Pakistani military was engaged in the major offensive push last year, there were conflicting reports about the numbers of militants and government soldiers killed. Do we have any idea of how many people were killed and how many civilians were killed during the heaviest period of fighting?
Short answer is no. I don't think there are any reliable figures for that.
We really have no idea just how bad this crisis is. What about Afghan refugees? Haven't they also been flooding into Pakistan?
No, I mean, there's still around about 2 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan, but the bulk of that population of people have been there often since the start of the Afghan refugee crisis way back in the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. The Taliban in Pakistan, it's often pointed out, is not exactly the same thing as the Taliban in Afghanistan, but they must be very closely related, aren't they?
It's more like a web, a network of groups. Both the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistan Taliban are not monolithic. Different commanders, different agendas within those movements. And then there are a lot of other militant groups like Lashkar-e-Jangvi, Lashkar-e-Islam, who are slightly separate from the Taliban but still interconnected.
The usual question at the end of one of these things, because the crisis is so grave, is what can the average person do?
I think the imperative right now is to bring Pakistan back onto the humanitarian agenda internationally. And for the average person, I mean, write to your congressperson, write to your senator, and make sure that they're paying attention to the continuing high levels of humanitarian need in Pakistan and supporting legislation and aid budgets that will go to meet those needs.
Michael Young is Asia Regional Director for the International Rescue Committee, and we've been talking about the ongoing refugee crisis in Pakistan with him as for our first underreported update. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.